Over many years coaching several sports, needless to say, I took a great number of losses. One more than I lost, just to note that, but I did take a significant number of losses. Very few of them still stick with me and really bother me. But I was thinking about one over the past couple of days that sadly was probably 10, 12 years ago, maybe, coaching football, Miss Carolyn over at Newport, before I ever got Dakota. But I was coaching 5 to 7 year olds. We were playing Havelock, and we were ahead, and they were driving down the field or right at the end of the game, and they ran a couple of plays, same play, a couple of times, got yardage with it, got right down to about the 2-yard line, had time for one more play. So in my head, I'm thinking, they ran the same play twice. It's worked both times. They're going to run it again. So I set the defense to stop that play. And guess what he did? He ran something else. Ran absolutely the other way, scored a touchdown. That was the end of the game. Now, I want you to notice what he did there. He was a very good coach, outcoached me on that occasion. I outcoached him some other times, but he outcoached me on that occasion. Because I want you to notice what he did. He knew ahead of time, by running those two, that play twice, he knew ahead of time what I was going to be thinking. He knew he'll think I'm going to run that again. So he set up a different play and ran that play. He was thinking farther ahead than I was. He was thinking 2 or 3 plays ahead when I had my head focused on that one play. This is why I've always been terrible at checkers. I've never even tried chess because I'm so horrible at checkers. Because what do you have to do to be good at checkers? You've got to be able to see several moves ahead, and I just can't do that. And I just always get my checkers right in a row with one space between them where you can just bam, 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 and it's over. Because I can't think more than one move ahead. You know, God would be awesome at checkers, wouldn't he? God would really, really be something at checkers when you think about it. Because God is always thinking and moving more than one move ahead. Our text this morning is Isaiah chapter 35. And I want to give us some background so that we can really understand what's going on in Isaiah chapter 35. In Isaiah chapter 35, Isaiah, of course, is the one who is prophesying. And when Isaiah is prophesying, 740 to 700 BC or so, when Isaiah is prophesying, Judah is still living in their land, but they are greatly deep into sin. It is a very wicked and sinful culture. And God, through Isaiah, is going to look down through time, and he's going to look down past the moment, or several moments over a period of several years, when the nation of Judah would be defeated because of their sin by Babylon, and they would be deported. And then God is going to see past that to that next thing that was going to happen. Because of that defeat and that deportation, they would undergo this spiritual distress, would the nation of Judah. And because they were in distress, and because they were God's people, Isaiah, through the Holy Spirit of God, he's able even to look past all of that, and he's going to look several moves ahead, and he's going to see that Judah would come out of captivity, and Judah would be restored. I want you to see how God is able to not only see the thing, but God is able to see the next thing. And God even is able to see past that thing to the next thing and the thing that's going to happen after that and even beyond that. God can see all of those things. This is an amazing passage, and I want us to really understand what it is that God is doing in this passage. In this moment, when Judah is still living in their land, and yet they're wicked, and they're going to be defeated and deported, God sees that. But he sees beyond that to the spiritual consequences. And he sees beyond that to the time when God would bring his people back. It would be as if I could see clearly and tell you today the result of the next election. And we all know how unreliable all the predictions, right? All the things that people say, oh, we know this is going to happen. We see, we can tell you statistics and all that. And how often does it not turn out that way? But if I could tell you in 2 years, here's exactly what's going to happen. Here's going to be who's elected. Here are going to be the states that go for this one and that one. But not only that, I could tell you the consequences, the economy, the military conflicts, all of those things. I can't tell you those things. No one can. Only God can see that far ahead. Notice what God is doing in these times of Judah's sin. In about 740 BC or so, God looks all the way down 200 years in the future and tells them exactly what's going to happen. It would be like Shakespeare being able to see and predict the U.S. Civil War. Can you imagine that? It's about the same time difference. If Shakespeare could look forward in time and predict accurately the U.S. Civil War, think of all the things that had to happen between Shakespeare and the Civil War. Or if George Washington were able to predict in his day the consequences of COVID, like, that would be unbelievable that someone could do that. That's exactly what God is doing here. He's looking down through time and he's seeing all of these things that will specifically happen. But there's something even more amazing than that. There's something even bigger that God is seeing. Because the problem in Judah in 740 BC was not simply the wickedness of a nation of about a million people in a tiny nation. That was not the real problem. The problem was not that these people would be defeated, that they would be deported, that they'd come back 70 years later. That's not the problem. Just as in America today, the problem is not gas prices. That is not our biggest problem. The problem is not supply chain. The problem is not politics. It's not parties. The problem is none of those things. The problem is much bigger than that. And as God is describing in Isaiah 35 what he's going to do for Judah, he is describing ultimately what he's going to do for all of mankind in his sin problem, because that's the real problem. It has nothing to do with the economy. It has nothing to do with politics. Politics is a symptom. Economy is a symptom. The world situation, a symptom. The problem is that mankind is lost in sin. That's the problem. And that's what God is going to deal with in reality. Isaiah chapter 35 looks beyond Judah, and it looks to the coming of Jesus Christ. You know, when we think about the broad sweep of history and where all these things play out, in reality, this is about much more than just a few hundred years. You know, here we are right here. Jesus has come. He has brought the solution to the sin problem. But what God is talking about in Isaiah 35 is even bigger than that. This is all part of a plan that was started before the world was ever created. And it's going to be consummated at the end of time, at the last day, when Jesus returns, when judgment happens, when the only two things that are left anywhere are eternity in heaven or in hell. This is exactly what Isaiah is talking about in Isaiah chapter 35. Now, here's what God is doing. God has gone beyond checkers. God's not playing checkers. You and I are trying to figure out checkers, and God is playing five-dimensional chess where you can move through time. That's what God is doing, right? God, forget checkers. God is not moving checkers around on the board. God is playing a much bigger game than that. And it's a game that started before the world was created and will go after the world is long gone. That's what Isaiah is telling us about in Isaiah chapter 35. I want you to notice how he describes their condition and what he says he's going to do about it in terms that they could clearly understand. Isaiah 35, and beginning in verse 1, the wilderness and the desert will be glad, and the Arabah will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will blossom profusely, and rejoice with rejoicing and shout of joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Encourage the exhausted, strengthen the feeble. Say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you, his people. All of this planning, God coming up with a plan before the world was ever created, and all of the things that God has been doing in Eden and in Abraham and in Israel and in Jesus and in America and everything that God has been doing must be leading up to something pretty special. And this is exactly the way that God describes it. And again, he does it in ways that they can understand. So let's go back for a moment and think about the world that these people lived in. Here is a map of the world, that part of the world that they lived in. Now, you see on that map a green semicircle. All right, what is that green semicircle right there in that part of the world, right? That's called the what? The Fertile Crescent. Right? And why is it called that? Because it follows the water courses, the Mediterranean Sea and the rivers and things like that, where there was fertility. Now you will notice that everywhere else around that map, it's not green, but it's what? It's tan. Why is that? Because the Fertile Crescent was the area of agricultural fertility. All of that other space was barren. All of that other space, you couldn't grow stuff in it. Because it was barren, because there wasn't water. And as we look more closely and we think about the area more specifically that these people lived in, notice the difference between the waste places and the fertile places. These are the things that he's talking about. He mentions to them the region that was called the Arabah. This is the region that was below the Dead Sea. And this is completely a wasteland. Nothing can grow there. It's too hot, not enough moist. There's nothing there. Nothing can grow there. And he talks about the desert in chapter 35 and in verse 1. That area between Palestine and Babylon that was completely dry and hot, where things did not grow. And he talks about the wilderness. Places like the wilderness of Judea, where John the Baptist preached, where Jesus went out and fasted for 40 days. Why did he go fast for 40 days? There's nothing to eat. There's nothing out there, right? And so these are the places that he's talking about. But I want you to notice what he says. God says, I'm going to take these places like the wilderness and I'm going to make them fertile and green like Lebanon was. I'm going to take the places like the desert, like the Arabian desert, so hot and dry, and I'm going to make it fertile, and I'm going to make it able to produce like Carmel does. I almost said caramel. I got candy on my mind. Like Carmel does. I'm going to take the Arabah, this place that was so hot and dry, where nothing could grow, and God said, I'm going to make it like the fertile plain of Sharon. Now, what exactly is it that he's talking about? A lot of people look at these passages and take them in a literal fashion, that this is literally what God is going to do. Listen, when Jesus comes back, all that stuff's going to be destroyed. When Jesus comes back, 2 Peter chapter 3 says, everything gets burned up, right? We haven't seen heat like there's going to be at the end of time. Global warming is a problem, but it's not the kind that people think. It's the kind when Jesus comes back and everything gets burned up. He's not talking about taking literal deserts and making them fertile places. What is he talking about? He's talking about taking people who have no ability in themselves to deal with their problems. People who have no ability, people who are under distress, people who are hurting, people who have challenges, people in hardship, people who are desperate and have no hope and no ability to help themselves. And God says, I'm going to make a change in them that you will never believe. So notice what he says about these people and what makes it so challenging. He's not just talking about them. He's talking about us as well. He's talking to those who are anxious and who are afraid. Does that sound familiar at all? Have you ever been worried? Have you ever been scared about anything? Have you ever been worried about something that you thought was going to happen? Or afraid of something that you feared could happen? Have you ever seen something coming that you were certain was going to occur and it terrified you? It became all that you could think about. It became an obsession in your mind. It dominated your thoughts, your feelings. It takes your appetite. It robs you of sleep. It harms your relationships. This is what he's talking about. The anxiety and fear that we often feel because of the problems that we have. Well, what's the result of that? Well, this is why he talks about those who are feeble, right? What does anxiety do? What does fear do to you? It takes your energy. It takes your ability to function. It saps your mental and physical and spiritual ability to function until finally, as he says, you become completely exhausted. You have no energy. You have no motivation. You have no way to get up and keep going. And everything in life begins to fall apart. This is the picture he paints. This is why he pictures them as a desert, a people completely unable to do anything for themselves. But I want you to notice what God says I'm going to do for them. The first thing I'm going to tell you that he says, you'll probably be able to believe. You'll probably buy it. The second thing that I'm going to tell you he says, you might be able to see it, might be able to believe that God can make that happen, sort of. The last thing that I'm going to tell you that God says he's going to do, you're not going to believe. You're not going to believe it. Because if you've ever experienced the kind of anxiety and fear that I'm talking about, in that moment, what he's going to say seems impossible. As impossible as making a desert into a fertile plain. But this is what he says he's going to do for those who are hurting. He says to those who are anxious and fearful, what he's going to bring them in verse 3 is encouragement and the ability to take courage. He's going to lift their spirits. He's going to help them to feel better. He's going to help them to begin to get some encouragement in the midst of this terrible fear and pain that they're experiencing. He said, well, okay, I can buy that. I can buy that God can make me feel a little bit better, maybe help me make it through the day. I can buy that. I can see where God could do that. The second thing that he mentions, though, is taking it to another level. Not only does he say, am I going to encourage you, I'm going to give you encouragement, I'm going to make you stronger. I'm going to give you the ability to get out of bed in the morning. And I'm going to give you the ability to put one foot in front of the other. I'm going to give you the ability and the strength to face the difficulties and challenges that you're dealing with. Now, probably so far, you can see that. The last thing he says, though, almost is impossible to believe. God says, not only am I going to give you encouragement, not only will I make you stronger, but he says, I will even make you rejoice and shout for joy. Not only would they just feel a little better, they're not just going to have a little strength, make it through the day, stumble back into bed that night. What he says is, I'm going to give you the ability to have a lasting and deep joy that nothing and no one can ever take away. Now, the good news about this is, there's nothing magical, there's nothing mystical, there's nothing particularly difficult about receiving what it is that God has. So how does he do that? Well, we'll notice that, and then we'll wrap up and be done. How is God going to bring us the ability to have comfort and strength and even joy? Well, by way of answering, I don't know if you've ever heard or read this conversation that happened between a tech support person on the phone and someone who called them when their computer stopped working. Technical support, how may I help you? Caller, I need help. I was just typing along and all of a sudden the words went away. What does your screen look like now? Nothing. Does your monitor have a power indicator? What's a monitor? It's the thing with the screen on it that looks like a TV. Does it have a little light that tells you when it's on? I don't know. Tell me if your computer is plugged into the wall. I can't see the plug. It's dark. Dark? Yes, the light is off. Turn on the light. I can't. You can't. Why not? Because there's a power outage. So you may have heard that story. There's a little addendum that's put on the end of it that the tech person then said, box up your computer, send it back, and tell them that you're too dumb to own a computer. That part did not happen. This part did happen. This actually did occur between tech support and a caller whose computer had quit working. Why had their computer stopped working? Because it was unable to access what? It was unable to access power. What we need to know is, when we're living in a desert, how do we access the power of God? I want to suggest three things to you, and then we'll wrap up and be done. Number one, prayer. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 3, and notice what Paul says about how we access the strength and the power that God has for us. Ephesians chapter 3. Notice that Paul begins this section by telling us what he's doing. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 14. For this reason, he says, I what? I bow my knees before the Father. Paul is talking about prayer. And his prayer is, in verse 16, that God would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be what? To be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man. And it's essential, as we engage in prayer for the power of God for our needs, that we remember what he says in verse 20, that you are praying to the one who is able to do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask or think, according to the power that lives within us. Psalm 119, notice in Psalm 119 how the psalmist talks about the role of the word in doing what it is that God can do for us. Psalm 119 and beginning in verse 25. He says in Psalm 119 and verse 25, my soul cleaves to the dust. He says that spiritually, he's face down in the dirt. He's completely collapsed. He has no energy. My soul cleaves to the dust. Revive me according to your word. I have told you of my ways. There's prayer again. He says, I've described to you what's going on in my life and what I need. You have answered me. So teach me your statutes. Make me understand the way of your precepts, so I will meditate on your wonders. My soul weeps because of grief. Strengthen me according to your word. And then finally, Exodus chapter 17 and the role of other believers. Exodus chapter 17. Exodus 17 gives us, in this part of the chapter, the account of Israel's battle with Amalek. And in Exodus chapter 17, it says that as Israel was fighting Amalek, in verse 10, Joshua did as Moses told him. Exodus 17:10. Joshua is fighting. Moses is watching from a hill. Joshua fought Amalek. Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. When he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. So get the picture. Moses is standing on the hill watching the Jews fight the Amalekites. And as long as Moses makes a touchdown sign, the people are winning. But how long can you do that? Especially at Moses' age. He's not as young as he used to be. How long can you keep your hands up? After a while, you got to drop them. Well, when he drops them, what happens? Israel starts to lose. So he puts them back up. And Israel starts to win. But he can't do that for very long. So what happens? Verse 12. Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. Notice this. Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side, one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Notice the situation that Moses was in. He had to keep his hands raised, but he was unable. So what happened? Two fellow believers came next to him, right next to him, got under his arms and raised his hands, doing for Moses what he could not do for himself. I honestly believe that there are times, because we are human, when there are situations that we face that are simply too much for us to bear alone. This is the reason that God has given us fellow believers to do exactly what Aaron and Hur had done, to come along beside us, to sit next to us, to hold up our hands, and to help us have a victory that we cannot have on our own. These are three things that you and I must do regularly. If we are not doing them regularly, we are on our way to desert status. We are on our way to becoming spiritual desert. If we are not regularly in prayer, if we are not regularly in the Word, if we are not regularly connected with other believers, then we are on the way to becoming a desert. Maybe you're not. Now is the time to be sure that you have a Bible study habit, a prayer habit, and a habit of being with other Christians. Maybe you find yourself now in a desert. You are completely incapable of responding to the situation that you find yourself in. It's never too late to begin to pray diligently, to study diligently, to reach out and connect with other believers diligently. This is what is required for us to receive the energy and power that God has for us. Well, next Sunday morning, Lord willing, we're going to begin a new series in Genesis. We'll begin with Genesis 4. It won't all be there. But beginning in Genesis chapter 4, on what it means to call on the Lord. Tonight, Lord willing, at 6 o'clock, we will be in Zechariah chapters 4 and 5 for our monthly Sunday night Bible study. That will be here at the building. And we'll be looking at Zechariah chapters 4 and 5. So, it might be, if you are not a Christian, as we're going to sing this song in just a moment, the number 466, if you want to take your songbook and turn to 466, and we'll sing that song in just a minute. If you are not a Christian, there is no way for a desert to become fertile, to grow, to have life apart from God. The only way to have spiritual life is by coming to the Father through the Son. If you are not a Christian and you're ready to find out more about how to do that, or you're ready to become a Christian, we're here to help you. If you are a Christian and there's some way that we can help you, if you're having difficulty, struggling, if you're hurting, if you have questions, whatever it is that you need, we want to help you. We're here to do so. We'd love to talk to anybody privately at the church, or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.